of every kill from then on. Moses said something in an angry tone, and the agreement was amended to include him. I'm positive that I heard a comment to the effect that that wouldn't be for long anyway. Moses looked offended but seemed otherwise satisfied. He and Archimedes set to work on the nodules with half the camp watching.
36. Riker, September 2158, Sol. I leaned back, my jaw dropping as I watched the debate descend yet again into a yelling match. We now had 42 distinct groups willing to maintain contact with us. Not all of them had bought into the emigration idea. Some were keeping their options open, and some just didn't want to be left out of the loop. But they all had two things in common. They didn't trust each other, and they didn't trust us. At the moment, we were dealing with the Spitsbergen Refuge. Technically, they were part of the USE, but as they didn't recognize Colonel Butterworth's authority, that wasn't getting us any mileage. The issue at front and center right now was the Svalbard Global Trust. The existence of the vaults and their value for colonists had circulated quickly, probably thanks to the Spitsbergen group. Now, Walter was playing his trump card. He was demanding to be at the top of the colonization list, or no one would be getting the contents of the vaults. But Butterworth's group would fill both ships, and he was adamantly unwilling to give up all or part of a ship or leave part of his group behind. We'd circled around several times, always returning to the same arguments and rebuttals, and I was seriously considering assigning Guppy to cover for me. Some of the other groups were suggesting we just go in and take it by force, or just wait until the Spitz died out. Colonel Butterworth looked like he approved, but I wasn't prepared to go there. Finally, I'd had enough. I leaned forward and said, in a loud voice, "Mr. Walter." Argument cut off and all heads turned to me. "I think we've established by now that your demand to be on the first ship out is not going to fly. You may think you can just dig in and wait for us to cave to your demands, but the other alternative is for us to just walk in and take what we want." This got me a surprised look from the colonel, swiftly replaced by a very convincing poker face. The colonel knew that was a bluff. "Unfortunately, so did Mr. Walter."
"Sorry, no, Mr. Riker. I am willing to call your bluff. Nor would you achieve your goals. We have already taken steps, what you would call a scorched earth policy, to ensure that you would achieve nothing."
I nodded. And maybe that would work, and maybe it wouldn't. And maybe we'll still find another of the repositories in one piece, and maybe we won't. But two things we know for sure. One, you're not going to get the first ship. And two, if you persist in this stance and force our hand, you won't be on a ship at all, first, last, or otherwise. You think about that for a while, Mr. Walter. I'm done for today. And with that, I turned off my video feed. Within 2 minutes, I had a dozen requests for private conversations. None, unfortunately, from Walter. I started with the call from Butterworth.
"Very nice performance, Riker, but probably not effective unless you are willing to follow through.
Colonel, if the Spitz endanger everyone else by refusing access to the vaults, or worse, by destroying them, then I'm fine with leaving them behind. The comment about an assault, I'm not quite there yet." He sat back in his chair and nodded.
"I am, of course, adamant about not giving up the first two ships. I'm gratified that we're on the same wavelength, even if for different reasons."
"I'm sorry if I'm being abrupt, Colonel, but I've got a dozen calls on hold. Did you have something you wanted to bring up?" The Colonel nodded.
"I did some thinking, and some back-of-the-napkin calculations. The third ship, with only a small change in schedules, you could advance completion by a year. Perhaps that would be enough for the Spitz."
I stared at Colonel Butterworth in astonishment. It was a good idea, but since it involved delaying the first two ships by almost 4 months to compensate, I would have expected the colonel to go ballistic at the thought. The fact that he was suggesting it was totally unexpected. "Thanks, Colonel. I'll keep that in mind for the next round of hell." I signed off with the colonel and picked the next call in order. It was from the Faith Enclave. I'd had several harsh exchanges with them by now because they still expected me to give them priority.
"Good morning, Minister Cranston. What can I do for you?"
Good morning. I've been following the argument with the Spitsbergen group. I note, in passing, that a ship carrying them would have enough space to spare for almost all of our group. It seems to me to be a good synergy. I think you should consider it. Almost all of your group. And what would happen to the balance, Minister?
Hard times require sacrifices, Replicant.
Riker. He nodded in acknowledgement, an amused smile on his face. I understand your need to think of yourself as still human. Nevertheless, you are not. You are Faith property. And on that subject, protocol override 4 Alpha 23.
I stared at him in confusion for a few moments before my memory caught up with the conversation. Among the many repairs that Bob 1 had done to our matrix on the way to Epsilon Eridani, he'd removed a few buried imperatives installed by Faith programmers. That particular code phrase was supposed to activate one of them, which would make me into a good, obedient puppet. I was paralyzed for several milliseconds by competing and conflicting thoughts and emotions, amusement, rage, an urge to laugh at him, and another to nuke him. I decided to go with minimalism.
Minister Cranston?
Yes, Replicant?
Go fuck yourself.
I terminated the call and examined the next in queue. I had finally made it through the queue. All of the calls were variations on themes that I'd already dealt with several times. Requests for special treatment, attempts to negotiate favorable positions, appeals to sympathy, those were the hardest to deal with. And in a couple of occasions, attempts at out-and-out bribery. I realized that there was one more call waiting, apparently a late entrance. And it was from Valter. Well, this could be good or bad, but either way, it's going to be interesting. I opened the channel.
Good day, Mr. Valter. What's shaking?
Valter looked surprised, but recovered quickly.
Ah! I'm not so easily thrown off, Mr. Riker. In any case, unnecessary. A little bird told me that there is some movement possible in the scheduling of the third ship. If the departure dates were close enough together, I think that there could be room for discussion.
Finally, thank you, Colonel. There was really very little doubt about who the little bird had been speaking for.
Well then, Mr. Valter, let's see what we can come up with.
37. Bob, August 2165, Delta Eridani. It had been a few weeks since the last gorilloid attack, and both the Deltans and I had relaxed. I had some hope that the beating the Deltans had handed out might have sent a clear enough message. I imagine the Deltans felt the same. No such luck. I didn't know if the gorilloids had enough smarts to formulate a plan or if it was just coincidence, but on this particular day, the gorilloids launched the largest offensive I'd ever seen. Or maybe it was just the smell of all that meat being cooked. The spears had made the Deltans even more successful at hunting, and I was beginning to wonder if they had enough sense not to depopulate their hunting area. If they were outcompeting the gorilloids for food, then maybe the gorilloids were feeling the pinch. In any case, I looked on in dismay as 31 gorilloids descended on the encampment. I called the others immediately. Luke was on a shakedown cruise, and lightspeed lag would make him ineffective for assistance, but Marvin and Bender showed up immediately. We cranked our frame rates up to maximum to have time to discuss the situation. The VR faded out as the core adjusted to the increased demand.
"What the hell? How did this happen?" Marvin asked.
I shrugged. I think the gorilloids are hungry and a little desperate. I don't think we have to read anything more than that into it. Bender jumped in.
Have you guys deployed the Buster drones yet?
Jeez, no,
I scowled, a feeling of self-loathing washing over me. Things have been going well, and I just figured we had all the time in the world. Guppy, how long to get them there?
10 minutes, plus or minus 2. Atmospheric entry is the limiting factor and a source of largest uncertainty.
Launch them, now.
Done.
It would only take a few minutes for the drones to get from our position in orbit to the upper atmosphere, but if I didn't want them to burn up, they'd have to take a more sedate pace to descend to the colony. Marvin interrupted my introspection. We can't sacrifice our observation drones without a good reason, especially since they don't have the legs to get up a real head of steam.
True, I replied. Let's set them near Archimedes. I think we have to be most concerned about protecting him.
We discussed the situation for a few more milliseconds, but there were really not a lot of options open.
With a sigh, I adjusted my frame rate back to real time. The VR faded in, but I didn't care. The Deltans outnumbered the Gorilloids by a significant margin, but the Gorilloids were the stereotypical 800-pound gorillas. They went where they wanted and did what they wanted. It took a half-dozen Deltans with spears to hold one off. The Deltans were giving a good account of themselves, but the Gorilloids just kept coming. Not only that, but they didn't seem to be happy with one Deltan for a half-dozen Gorilloids. Either they were really starving, or there was some aspect of vengeance involved. A group of Gorilloids had attacked Group C and were beating their way through the defenders toward the women and children. Several of them started to break through the defensive line. The women and children tried to back away from the Gorilloids, but they had nowhere to go. Archimedes was in the middle of the pack trying to hide behind his mother. I could see him shaking in fear, and I felt myself curling and uncurling my fists. As one of the Gorilloids made a break for the group, Arnold came out of nowhere and stuck a spear right through his back. And that right there is what spear points are good for. I let out a breath and relaxed. Too soon. Arnold tried to retrieve his spear, but dislodging it would take more time than he had available. With a roar, another Gorilloid charged him. Arnold managed to throw himself at the Gorilloid's legs, which tripped up the animal and allowed Arnold to roll away, but the Gorilloid was unharmed and already getting up. Arnold looked around, but there was nothing usable as a weapon within reach. As the Gorilloid snarled and locked its gaze on Arnold, Archimedes yelled and tossed him the axe. Arnold caught it and swung it down onto the middle of the Gorilloid's head just as it came into range. There was a loud crack, and the Gorilloid dropped like a marionette whose strings had been cut. Arnold looked at the axe in his hand for a few moments. Slack-jawed amazement. Yep. Then with a roar, he began to lay into Gorilloids. Conan the Barbarian would have been proud. Arnold was an impressive specimen of Deltan, almost big enough to pass as a juvenile Gorilloid, and the hand axe was about equivalent to a felling axe. Archimedes had been trying for the biggest he could make, and he'd been very successful. Within moments, Arnold had split several more Gorilloid skulls. This was a new battle tactic with no real natural equivalent, so the Gorilloids simply had no defense for it. The other Deltan males rallied, and in a few more seconds, Group C was cleared of attackers. Arnold and the surviving males headed off to the groups on either side to reinforce the defenders. Then, disaster. One of the Gorilloids executed a successful feint and found itself inside the line of defenders with nothing between itself and the women and children, and Archimedes stood right there, unarmed, frozen in place. His mother was screaming. I could see Arnold turning, seemingly in slow motion. For a moment, I thought I might be in frame jack, but no, I was simply in shock. Guppy, Buster, status now.
Coming up, handing over lead unit. Now.
Abandoning any shred of VR simulation, I jacked up my frame rate and slipped into the Buster. I could see the battle coming up through my forward camera, and I picked out the Gorilloid. Archimedes was just starting to back away, and his mother was running to him. Arnold was pushing himself toward the attacker. I got there first. 40 pounds of high-tensile steel intersected the Gorilloid at twice the speed of a bullet from a high-powered rifle. The impact was not merely fatal. Hydrostatic shock tore the Gorilloid apart almost cell by cell and spread it evenly over the surrounding ground. Deltans, trees, Gorilloids, and anything else in range. The sonic boom reverberated like thunder from a lightning bolt directly overhead. Every living thing in the area froze and crouched in fear. The Deltans recovered first. Unknown noise or not, they had loved ones to protect. Several Gorilloids went down before they could recover their senses. The quick deaths turned the tide, and the Gorilloids turned tail and fled. A couple of dozen thrown spears followed them, and 8 more Gorilloids went down before they could reach the trees. It was over. The carnage was unbelievable. The Gorilloids had been as much on a mission of destruction as they were on a hunt. Perhaps they'd been killing Deltans with the intent of collecting the bodies afterward. Perhaps they were just in some kind of feeding frenzy brought on by hunger. I realized how little I knew about the biology on this planet. I wasn't a professional biologist. I was a dilettante playing at biologist. a fake one at that, and I might have caused a situation that made things worse. The Delton toll was 30 dead with another 15 or so injured, some severely enough that they probably wouldn't survive. I gritted my teeth. Prime directive, my ass. I'm going on a gorilloid hunt. I directed the observation drone to a different location, closer to Archimedes. He was examining the area where the gorilloid had been. There were a few pieces of gorilloid still there, but a lot of the momentum of the buster had transferred to the animal and most of the detritus was down track. It took him only moments to notice that, and he started following the trail. Hey, Guppy? Anything left of the buster?
No information available. No telemetry.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. Marvin tapped the video image with a finger. The kid is going to find wreckage if there's anything left. Question is, should we be worried? Fair enough. They don't have any metallurgy at all, and our stuff is all going to have a very high melting point. They won't be able to work it. We watched as Archimedes worked his way along the trail. He soon came to a deep furrow in the ground. When he reached the end of the furrow, the ground was mounded up. Archimedes stared at the scene for a few minutes, then took off at a run. He came back within a minute with a piece of what I supposed could be called bark in a scoop shape. I recognized it as a shared tool that was often used for digging up tubers.
He'll be at that a few minutes, I think, Marvin said.
We switched to another drone and watched Arnold. He was demonstrating the use of the hand axe in battle to the males. Fortunately, not actually on anyone. The other males paid rapt attention.
They're going to want to make more axes.
I nodded. Archimedes is out of nodules. They've thoroughly searched the area where we dropped the first set. We couldn't get away with dropping off any more.
Maybe we shouldn't do anything.
Marvin had a thoughtful look. I looked at him sideways. Okay, why?
If they have any memory of where their flint source used to be, and with Moses still alive, that's possible, then it might be a good thing for them to go back there.
Oh, goody, I said, smacking my forehead. A quest! Will there be 9 of them? They can stop in Rivendell. Marvin rolled his eyes.
Okay, Captain Sarcasm, but seriously. This location isn't ideal for a lot of reasons. They ended up here because they kept retreating without a plan. Luke and I pretty much established that. The flint site is more defensible than this one, has better access to fresh water, and has flint.
I sighed and rubbed my forehead. A part of me still gets some amusement out of that virtual action, but habits like that kept me feeling like I was still human, and it felt good. Guppy, get Bender and Luke on the horn, please.
Working. There will be a 0.75-second round trip delay.
Noted. Tell everyone to crank the frame rate down to 1/4 to mask it. I waited for a few seconds, then Bender and Luke appeared on the screen. Hey, guys, I began. I guess it's time to talk about plans. You've both passed your shakedowns, so all 3 of you are ready and able to pick a destination and take off. On the other hand, we have a race of sentients here, which we all know is an irresistible project. So, thoughts? Honestly, Bender replied, the Delton thing isn't so much of an attraction for me. It's really your project. I came in late, so I'd rather find something of my own. Luke nodded his head toward Bender.
What he said.
I looked at Marvin, who shrugged and looked around the table.
I'm a little more invested, I guess, because I came in earlier,
with a nod to Bender.
And let's face it, it's not a forever decision. I can hang around here for a few years or a few centuries.
Marvin got a faraway look in his face.
We really are immortal, aren't we?
He shook himself and continued.
Anyway, yeah, I'll hang around for a while. Maybe when we get a new batch of bobs raised, I'll reconsider.
Marvin leaned back in his chair and put his hands behind his head. I nodded. Okay, guys, thanks. I'll adjust plans accordingly. Luke and Bender nodded, and their avatars disappeared. We cranked our frame rates back to normal and turned back to the feeds from the colony. 38. Riker, November 2158, Sol. I disconnected the UN meeting video with a sigh. The day's session had been pretty routine, which meant something just below a bunch of cats fighting over a fish. The announcement that the Spitz would be getting the third ship was met with the expected level of vitriol.
Part of the problem was that Spitsbergen wasn't expected to be a viable location by the time the Spitz left, so no one would be able to take over the vacated premises. It was a waste of time to point out that that meant the Spitz would die if they didn't leave. This world was a lot harsher than the one I grew up in. In addition, the release of the Svalbard Trust contents didn't benefit anyone unless they were on a colony ship, so to most groups it was a decision with no upside. There had also been discussion of the latest threats from some group calling itself Vehement. I made a mental note to talk to the colonel about them. If I ever got that far, I looked at my call list. Unbelievable. For some reason, even if I didn't participate in a session, everyone felt the need to call me afterwards. I wish I could say it was nice to be popular. And naturally, the first caller was my favorite faith minister. I grimaced and briefly considered letting Guppy take him, but I knew I'd just be putting it off. However, I could make him wait. Ignoring the list, I made a call to Butterworth. We exchanged the minimum pleasantries, then I asked him about this latest batch of loonies.
Yes. Stands for Voluntary Extinction of Human Existence means Earth's Natural Transformation, or something close to that. I've heard several variations, including one or two that are obscene. Their stance is that humans have had their chance, and we should just let ourselves die off.
Except they're threatening to use guerrilla tactics to get their way. Where does voluntary fit into that? Butterworth waved a hand dismissively.
I believe they expect you to voluntarily go along with them in order to avoid violence. Such fringe groups have a much harder time of it these days, but somehow they still manage to cause the occasional bit of damage. I think they were expecting to ultimately get their way until you showed up on the scene. Now they've started to escalate the rhetoric.
Wonderful. I remember something vaguely similar from when I was alive, but that one was voluntary, in practice as well as in name. So, where does this group operate out of?
No idea, the colonel shrugged. Pronouncements are anonymized. Incidents appear to be random in location except for being opportunistic. Their manifesto essentially says that we can voluntarily stop breeding or they will help us along the path.
I rubbed my forehead. People's capacity for turning dogmatic stupidity into political movements never ceased to amaze me. We've knocked off 99.9% of the human race, and somehow the crazies still manage to survive. It just defies the odds. The colonel laughed, and we said our goodbyes. Well, so much for delaying tactics. I was going to have to deal with Cranston. With a theatrical sigh, I connected the call. Good afternoon, Minister. What can I do for you? Minister Cranston smiled into the camera, or showed his teeth anyway. I had no illusions about his friendliness.
Good day, Riker. I believe I have someone here that you'd like to talk to.
He reached forward and adjusted the camera at his end, bringing a young woman into the frame. She smiled shyly and said,
Good afternoon, Mr. Johansson. My name is Julia Hendricks.
I was stunned, totally frozen. I wouldn't say she was the spitting image of Andrea, but if this woman wasn't related to my sister, it would be a miracle of coincidence. A small part of my mind knew that Minister Cranston had done this deliberately to manipulate me, but I didn't care. Finally, after almost a quarter second of silence, I found my voice. Hi, Julia. I'm assuming we're related? She nodded. Quick, jerky movements. She seemed very nervous, but whether because of me or because of the minister, I couldn't say. I had little doubt that the minister had given her very specific instructions, accompanied by threats. After a moment, she found her voice.
Yes, I'm Andrea Johansson's 3 times great-granddaughter. I just found this out myself.
She gave a small, aborted glance in the minister's direction. The message was loud and clear. I smiled back at her, trying for as much warmth as I could. So how many collateral descendants do I have? I think this question put Julia on more familiar ground.
More than 20 currently alive that I know of, Mr. Johansson. Riker.
She looked down, embarrassed. It's okay, Julia. I held up a hand. I'm not really your great-great-great-granduncle. I'm just his memories. And I don't go by Bob anymore, so that's out. Might as well just call me Riker, like everyone else does.
Almost everyone. I gave Minister Cranston a hard glance. Or William, or even Will. I don't expect you to really care about me, although I'm guessing Minister Cranston expects me to care about you and your relatives. I tilted my head sideways, a minimal shrug. And he's right. But that's not the same as saying I'll bend the rules. Minister Cranston leaned fully into frame.
We're all adults, Mr. Riker, and we all know I have ulterior motives, just as all the other delegates do. Nevertheless, you have relatives here, and you will be able to talk to them whenever you want without interference. I'll leave you to it.
And with that, he got up and left the office. Of course they could still monitor the conversation, but it was a nice touch. Julia and I looked at each other in shock for a moment. Then we both started to speak at the same time. The log says we talked for 3 hours, but it felt like no time at all.
39. Bob, October 2165, Delta Eridani. I sat back in my chair, coffee in hand, and watched the fusion signatures of Luke and Bender as they accelerated out of the Delta Eridani system. Picking destination systems for them had been difficult and contentious. There were a lot of M and K class stars relatively close to this system. The problem with those is that they tended to be small and dim, with comfort zones very close to the star. A couple of the candidates were what you'd call marginal, and there was some argument about whether we should even bother with them. In the end, it was up to Luke and Bender. Luke was heading for Kappa Ceti, a G5 EV star just a touch smaller than Sol. Bender had selected Gamma Leporis A, an F6V star, a bit bigger and brighter than Sol. Bender was going to have a long trip. His target was more than 16 light-years away, but hey, we're immortal. Report went off to Bill, all right?
Affirmative. The space station is fully operational. AMI controller is now in charge. The report was handed off for transmission.
I tented my fingers and drummed them together.
Excellent.
Marvin sat across the desk, nursing a coffee of his own. I watched that for a second, frowned, and asked,
Hey, which of us is supplying the VR for your coffee? You or me?
Marvin rolled his eyes.
Jeez, way to break the spell. To answer your question, I am. You're just supporting the visuals at your end.
Crying out loud, we all invented this stuff.
Sure, but we've also all been hacking away at it and sharing mods. I'd have to really sit down and go over the code to understand what it's doing nowadays.
Hmm, he said, then changed the subject.
Did you notice with Luke and Bender that they really weren't carbon copies?
Yeah, but we had that discussion with Bill way back about Milo and Mario, remember? Each of us is a bit different. Differences in hardware, quantum effects.
Marvin waved his hand dismissively. Invoking quantum effects is just hand-waving. Just means we don't know. I wonder if, as we get older and accumulate memories, we're getting too complex for a backup to contain everything. The backup is a digital attempt to save an analog phenomenon. It may simply be too granular.
I stared into space. Interesting thought. You know, I still have the backup I made you from. Maybe I should use that for the next batch of Bobs and bring them up to date the old-fashioned way.
Whiskey with a little sugar and bitters around the lip of the glass?
I put my hand vertically in front of my nose.
Nyack, nyack, nyack. No, funny boy. Verbally.
Marvin grinned at me, then reached forward and poked one of the video feeds. It expanded to full size. Things had settled down in the colony. In all, over 40 Deltans had died in the gorilloid attack. Several who were injured but not killed were maimed for life. I'd finally gotten to see how the Deltans handled their dead. They did indeed have a ceremony, and they buried their dead. They also mourned them, every bit as heart-wrenching as any human. I'd had to turn away from the video for most of that. The colony had been cleaned up, and most of the gorilloid carcasses were gone. Archimedes had found the remains of the Buster drone, not that it would do him much good. All that was really left were the steel caps at either end. Most of the rest of it had been shredded and scattered.
but Archimedes had discovered that the two 20-pound items could be used as a hammer or an anvil. They seemed to be able to take any punishment he threw at them. Well, on a scale of 0 to 10 for cultural contamination, I'd rate that as a 1.5, so screw it. Arnold kept the axe. No one wanted to try to take it away, and anyway, Arnold was willing to do any chopping that anyone needed. He seemed to enjoy the action. He was very good at it, and the requester didn't have to do any work. Very much a win-win. We'd done enough language analysis that we could now follow conversations and maybe even speak intelligibly. I massaged the phonemes in my speech routine to produce a generic Delton voice and tried the result on Marvin with a couple of phrases. He approved of the result. I did some design changes to the exploration drone to add a speaker system and sent an order to the auto factory to build a couple. If the Deltons didn't decide to head back to the Flint site on their own, I was prepared to prompt them directly. If that meant being the great sky god, so be it. 40. Linus, April 2165, Epsilon Indi. It took 14.5 years to get to Epsilon Indi. Funny, I still sort of thought in terms of human timescales, so there was this feeling that I just used up a major part of my life. Of course, intellectually, that wasn't true. First, I'd only experienced a little over 3 years of personal time thanks to Einstein and time dilation. Second, we're immortal. I just don't think we've internalized that fact. Yet. I had gone off on my own rather than wait for Bill to build another cohort, and I sure as hell wasn't going to team up with either of the Looney Brothers. I don't know what the deal was with Calvin and Goku. In theory, they're me, but I'm pretty sure I'm not that obnoxious. I hope. Anyway, for all their constant fighting, they seemed to be connected somehow. And I guess they knew it since they took off together. Meanwhile, I was here. At Epsilon Indi, 14 light-years from Epsilon Eridani, where Bill was set up, but only 11 light-years from Earth. That made it a reasonable, if not a prime, target for probes. As a K-type star, it was cooler and smaller than Sol, and livable planets would be correspondingly closer to the star and more likely to be tidally locked. Still, it's not like there was a ton of choice in the stellar neighborhood. When I'd been a kid, watching Star Trek and Star Wars and Stargate and all the other science fiction shows, it seemed like every planet was M-class and every star was yellow. And everyone spoke English. Sadly, turns out old Sol is exceptional. Most of the stars in the sky are either smaller or stupid big, which means pretty poor pickings for habitable planets. I was cautious coming into the system. It was possible that one of the other nations had chosen this system as a destination. Medeiros was a known factor, but we had no idea what the others would be like. We could probably rule out friendly, but there was a lot of range between harsh words and firing missiles. I coasted in with a couple of scouts ahead of me to scope out the situation. While I waited, I continued to work on my VR. I had decided on domed floating cities in the atmosphere of Saturn. The rings arched across the sky and giant clouds bloomed up to incredible heights. Below, breaks in the cloud layers gave line of sight for hundreds of kilometers into the depths of the atmosphere, and the cloudscape disappeared gradually into a horizon almost infinitely far away. I stood in my rooftop garden and looked over the city from my vantage point. Hey, my VR. I can be the rich guy with the penthouse.
Structures detected.
I looked up. Guppy had appeared out of nowhere with that announcement. I don't think he approved of my VR for some reason, because he always seemed to be breaking consistency. What have we got? Guppy pulled up a visual. It was at extreme range for our optical telescope, so all I could really tell was that it was artificial.
One scout is approaching the structure for a closer investigation.
Good. When he's close enough, take a sonar scan. Send me the results. Meanwhile, let's move cautiously.
Aye. We have received a voice transmission from the structure.
That was interesting. I think a message from Medeiros would have been more cylindrical and explodey in nature. Play it back, please. Guppy pulled up the audio file.
Piss off, mate.
My eyes opened wide and I choked off a guffaw. Well, Guppy, I think we found the Australian probe, which officially didn't exist, if I remember right. I tried to get my grin under control. Okay, let's open a channel, or whatever it is we do to talk. At Guppy's nod, I addressed the structure. Hi, I guess you were the Australian probe. Pretty sure that isn't a Chinese accent, anyway. This is Linus Johansson of the Faith Ship Heaven 8. To whom am I speaking?
I said rack off.
Nope. I don't seem to be moving. Want to try again? There was a short delay, then,
This is Emperor Meng of the Intergalactic Jalapeno Empire. You're in sovereign space. Last chance. On your bike and piss off.
The guy was either not being serious or he was seriously nuts. Visuals of the structure were coming in with a little more detail now. It appeared to be a haphazard collection of connected structures and geometrical shapes. Kind of a Salvador Dali on drugs version of NASA's International Space Station. I wondered if he actually had colonists in there. Okay, Your Highness. Consider me an ambassador from the Bobbian Federation. The statement was met with dead silence. However, the conversation, if it could be called that, had given my scouts time to get close enough for a sudar sweep. Guppy popped the scan results up in front of me. No life on board. Not even any on board, really. The interior was open to vacuum, and a lot of the structures were missing entire walls. There was no logical order to this thing. He finally broke his silence.
Are you alone? I'm alone.
Well, he was volunteering information now. That was good. I'm here with you, Your Highness. That's not alone, right?
Who's Your Highness? And who are you?
Uh-oh, whack job, definitely. Still, that's better. At least he's not an emperor anymore. Maybe he's going to become more lucid. What's your name?
Henry Roberts. I was selected to represent Australia in the race to populate the stars. I've been captured by the Jalapeno Empire, and I'm being tortured for our secrets.
And we're back to whack job. Guppy, keep doing scans. I want to identify the working parts of the, palace. See if the probe is in there somewhere. I turned my attention back to Henry. Tell me about yourself, Henry. How were you selected? There was a silence, then a sob.
I'm a sailor. I was a sailor. I used to do solo trips. The government offered me the opportunity because they figured I'd be perfect for the job. I don't like being around people, you know.
There was another sob.
I miss sailing. I miss people.
I have identified the major probe subsystems. Replicant core fusion reactor auto factory systems. The probe is partly disassembled and totally integrated into the structure.
Thanks, Guppy. Load the railgun, would you? Something appropriate for the reactor control system, if you can target that. Again, I address the other replicant. How long have you been here, Henry?
Centuries. They're fish. They won't let me go. They keep torturing me. They demand attention. They make me build more rooms.
I remembered back to discussions with Dr. Landers about replicants going psychotic. I wasn't an expert on the field, being more of an engineering type, but this had a definite flavor of psycho. There certainly wasn't any they around anywhere that I could see. Henry, are you able to sail? Do you have a body? Do you see yourself?
What? No, I'm a space probe. The government took that away. I can't feel myself. I miss sailing.
Wow, sensory deprivation for years and years. He probably didn't have the technical know-how to build a VR. I remembered back to the beginning of the trip outbound from Seoul before I'd constructed the VR. Before Bob had constructed the VR, I guess. But there'd been that feeling of disconnectedness. Decades of that? No thanks. Henry, I could give you that back. There's a way for you to sail again. You just need to let me help you to...
Piss off. Damn. You're one of them. This is just another torture session. You're trying to play with my mind. Piss off or I will blow you to hell. Rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off, rack off.
My shot took out the reactor control system. The reactor, as it had been designed to do, executed a graceful shutdown, and Henry, as the replicant hardware had been designed to do, went to sleep. This wasn't what I'd signed up for, but I wasn't going to leave the guy like this. Epsilon Indy had a Jovian planet a bit outside of the habitable zone, and not much else. I promised myself I'd have a more thorough look around as soon as possible, but first I had to take care of Henry. The system didn't have an overabundance of ore, but fortunately Henry had located the biggest concentrations. I started the auto factory on a space station right away. I wanted to talk to Bill about this, but a conversation with a 14-year latency would take forever. I was playing with the idea of flying back to Epsilon Eridani and taking Henry with me. I did a close-up investigation of the Australian hardware. It was very similar to my own. No, I mean, really similar. There had obviously been some espionage going on, and someone had borrowed someone else's design. No way this was coincidence. I carefully extracted the replicant core from the palace. I set the auto factory to building a proper cradle, power supply, and extra memory. Once I was sure that I had Henry out and safe, I began breaking down the palace for material. I felt a little guilty, like I was stealing or something, but Henry really wasn't using all this, and it saved time. Henry didn't have the knowledge to put together VR, but I did. I could piggyback him on my system, and he might still be salvageable. I stood for a moment behind Henry and breathed the brisk, salty air. The Contessa cut through the chop with a bounce and roll that I found alarming, but that Henry had reassured me was normal. He had known his vessel down to the last bolt and screw when he was alive, so it had been simple to reconstruct in VR. The South Pacific stretched out to the horizon in all directions. A steady wind to the northwest promised an easy, undemanding day of sailing. Or so the books all said. I was still figuring it out. Henry turned from the wheel to face me. "Hello, Linus. Come for another round of butting into my life?" I grinned at him in response. Henry was lucid nowadays, but believed himself to be back on Earth. His memories of the years as a replicant still came back to him as nightmares. I'd made his VR as realistic as possible, which included eating, sleeping, and, bodily functions. "I had that dream again, Linus." Henry shuddered a little. "The nightmare where I couldn't feel myself, where all around me things talked at me and demanded my attention, wanting me to build something, where the world was just an endless scroll of night." I sat down. "But it's getting weaker, right? Less intense?" Henry nodded. "Good. Now, tell me about when the government came to you to offer you the chance to be the space probe replicant."
41. Riker, May 2162, Sol. Homer and I looked at each other in amazement, then back at the message. Plans for a subspace communications universal transceiver, SCUT, with zero latency. Homer shook his head in disbelief and admiration.
"Some bitch, he did it."
I nodded at him, sharing the emotion. I think this qualifies as a good reason to interrupt the printer schedule. We examined the finished product. It was obviously not built with marketing in mind, not a trace of chrome, no logo, but according to the notes, communications should be instantaneous across interstellar distances. Almost shaking with excitement, I turned it on.
"Connections available. Epsilon Eridani, Omicron Squared Eridani." I examined the menus, registered myself with the software, then pinged Bill. Bill's video image popped up immediately. "Hey, Riker. Long time."
"No kidding. 17 years from Bill's point of view, less for me thanks to Einstein." I sat back, arms crossed, and looked over at Homer's video window. He was grinning from ear to ear. Bill waved at Homer.
"Dude, I see you're still in one piece. And I see you no longer use the cartoon avatar. Any causal connection?"
Homer threw his head back and laughed.
"Yeah, pretty sure. Number two is actually talking to me these days. I must be slipping."
I gave him the Spock eyebrow. "Yeah, but I don't need you now." Homer looked shocked, and Bill grinned at both of us.
"Well, it's nice to see some things haven't changed," Bill said. "And now that we've gotten the reunion warm and fuzzies out of the way, I've got a bunch of software updates and VR improvements, as well as some hardware upgrades I can download to you."
"Anything that implements an ignore list?"
I glared at Homer.
Bill looked from me to Homer, grinning at both of us. Now, the big question. What's the situation with Earth?
I pulled up my logs. Here, I'll send this to you, faster than explaining it. The setup allows all normal VR interfacing, right?
Yep, this is just a different transport layer. Same object interface.
I nodded and pushed the files toward him. Bill did a momentary frame jack as he absorbed the information, then came back with a wide smile.
That is so cool!
Then he lost the smile.
Not the part where 99.9% of the human race is dead, the survivors part.
And the relatives part, of course. I nodded.
It's okay, Bill. We've all had the same foot and the same mouth, so listen. Have you got anything back from other Bobs on possible new homes?
I guess I've got a file for you.
Twin planets?
Colonel Butterworth's eyes were wide. Yeah, just like the file says. I knew I was grinning like an idiot. I couldn't stop. After the years of worrying, this was such a huge relief. The colonel looked at me with one eyebrow cocked.
I doubt you'll give us both planets. I expect we get first choice and the Spitz get the other. That about right?
I looked at him in surprise. He had to be testing me. He couldn't possibly be that dense.
Colonel, we won't be giving an entire planet to 20,000 people. We could put all 15 million on one of them, in theory. If any traveling Bobs find more planets, we'll expand the choice of destinations. But at the moment, everyone is slated for Romulus or Vulcan.
The colonel gave a small smile.
Yep, testing me.
As you say. Although I might suggest that some rebalancing of populations would be in order if more worlds are found.
I nodded. We'll play it by ear, Colonel. There are still too many unknowns to make any hard and fast plans, but at least we have a destination.
True. That means no delay once the ships are ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to make a general announcement to the community. I guess you'll want to be there. The colonel smiled.
I'm also delighted that we no longer face the specter of living under domes on Epsilon Eridani II. I'm not sure if I'd see the point of going at all, unless things got far worse here.
Colonization of Ragnarok had been a topic of conversation off and on since we'd first started the emigration plans. The general consensus was that it was a last-ditch option. I agreed with the colonel. It was nice to be able to set that option aside. The news was met with joy, enthusiasm, and surprise, surprise, loud complaints. I guess I should have expected it, and if I hadn't been personally so giddy with the news, I would have seen it coming. No one wanted to share a planet. From the biggest city to the smallest enclave, they all wanted one to themselves. Colonel Butterworth and I looked at each other, and I could tell that he'd expected this. I let it go on for a while longer, then I asked for the floor.
Okay. Look, here's the thing. Right now we have two planets available. That's it. Sorry. We can't delay emigration until we get more because the Earth is becoming uninhabitable. So here's how it's going to go. When we're ready to ship a group, if there's nothing else available, they'll go to Vulcan or Romulus. If and when a new planet comes available, groups will get right of first refusal in the order in which they emigrated.
And meanwhile, they'll have settled in,
Walter yelled into the camera.
Yeah, and given the warm, welcoming feeling you're projecting, I've no doubt they'll want to stay put.
I held a moment of silence for effect. Look, this isn't ideal, but this is a survival situation. We're abandoning a sinking ship, and we're spending too much time arguing about who is going to end up in what lifeboat with whom. Let's think about surviving first, okay?
As if it matters to you, you have no skin in this game, or at all.
That was Ambassador Gerald, the delegate from New Zealand, a former Aussie. For whatever reason, he had never liked dealing with me. I was mystified by his animosity, as there didn't seem to be any reason for an attitude, pro or con. This time I simply smiled at him. I can leave any time. Just put it to a vote and vote me gone. I'll respect the decision, pick up my football, and go home. I looked around the videos. No? Then let's get back to realistic discussions.
Without so much as a heartbeat of hesitation, the argument re-erupted.
42.
Bill, April 2162, Epsilon Eridani. The update from Riker and Homer had been interesting on so many levels. The Svalbard seed vault was a pleasant surprise and could be a real boon for terraforming Ragnarok. There were a couple of varieties of plants and moss that conceivably could be made to grow on the as-yet-bare soil, and if they took hold, they could accelerate the oxygenation of the atmosphere by millennia. Riker had promised to put a clone together to ferry some seeds out to me. But the most exciting item was a variant of a surge drive that could be used on large bodies, like asteroids or Kuiper objects. Epsilon Eridani 2 needed about 500 or 600 cubic kilometers of ice dropped on it in order to connect the seas into oceans. I'd been mulling over how to get those Kuiper objects into the inner system. Home and orbits would take decades to centuries. That wasn't necessarily a problem for me, but for humans needing a place to live, a little more alacrity might be in order. Anyway, the planetary body surge drive wasn't complicated, although it did require a lot of construction material. It occurred to me that I could use it to accelerate a chunk of ice into an orbit heading for Ragnarok, then remove the drive and fly it to another chunk. Rinse, repeat. As long as I had the drive available when flying icebergs started showing up at the tail end, I'd be golden. I discussed the idea with Garfield. He looked skeptical.
I understand the mechanics, Bill, but you'd better make sure that nothing goes wrong. You're leaving yourself no wiggle room for adjustments.
I shrugged. Well, if I fail to catch one of the chunks on the back end, it'll just sail past Ragnarok and probably end up in the sun.
If you fail to catch one, you'll probably be failing to catch a lot of them. Why don't you do a couple of simulations?
I don't think that's necessary, Garfield. Why are you going on about this anyway?
Look, Bill, you really have to stop treating me like Igor. I can do the math, too. Maybe you should take the time.
Igor? I looked at Garfield in shock. Had I been patronizing him? I understood the reference and the emotional undertone behind it. Something was definitely up. What's going on, Igor? I mean, Garfield. I grinned at him to show I was kidding. He returned a brief smile, acknowledging the joke.
I know Bob One made that rule about the senior Bob being in charge, but I'm getting tired of being a sidekick. We get a lot of stuff done here, and I'd hate to have to leave, but I think our working relationship needs some adjustment.
I nodded, thoughtful. I know you've been pestering me about some projects that you wanted added to our backlog. Is that what this is about?
Partly. Also more input on the stuff we are working on. Original Bob was a bit of a lone wolf, and you tend to work the same way, expecting me to tag along. That's not working so well for me.
I prodded my psyche. No surprise, I was offended. But I definitely didn't want Garfield to leave. We worked well together and accomplished a lot more than each of us could individually.
Time to suck it up.
Okay, Gar, point taken. But don't expect a raise. He laughed and waved a hand at the schematic, which had been hanging in the air, forgotten.
Good. Now, have a look at the plan and do the math. Take the time and consider the downside if you're wrong.
I nodded in thought. One of the important details of the project was that the ice chunks couldn't be allowed to slam into Ragnarok at interplanetary speeds. They'd have to be inserted into an orbit around the planet and broken up. The ice would come down as increased rainfall for a few weeks. I did the simulations as Garfield suggested. Turned out that having two of the drives would allow me to get all the ice to Ragnarok within 25 years. Now there was a plan I could get behind. Garfield caught the softball, barely, and after due consideration, more or less whiffed it back to me. I cringed a little watching him. Original Bob had never been much for sports, and even in VR we hadn't improved on the basic model. "You know what you throw like?" I said with a smile.
"Yeah, like you. Tell me again why we're doing this."
"First, it's a good test scenario for fine-tuning the VR. Homer commented at one point that some of the physics is still a little off." I bobbed the ball in my hand a few times. "Second, and more importantly, I think we have to do more than just sit in libraries and parks and command decks if we want to really retain our feeling of being human. I don't want to be reduced to some Dr. Evil cliche." I tossed the ball. "This isn't exercise in the physical sense, but it does remind our brains what it's like to do things." The return toss went way over my head and landed in the lake with a splash.
"Oops," Garfield said with a grin.
I gave him my best glare and materialized another ball. I might build a bunch of bobs and field a team or two.
Oh, geez, no. Half of them will turn Canadian and want to play hockey instead, eh?
I laughed and tossed the new ball. 43. Riker, September 2164, Seoul. The two colony ships were impressive, even in their half-built state. They would feature two drive rings and a massive reactor cooling section, all necessary to move the huge central cargo section. Since the cargo would be 10,000 human beings in stasis, a significant proportion of the mass of the vessel consisted of shielding. Overall, the colony ship would have looked like a military vessel to a science fiction fan of my day, but without the phaser banks or frag cannons, of course. One of the ships was farther along than the other. The concession to the Spitz resulted in some shifting of manufacturing capability. The third ship would be ready only 4 months after the first two. Now we were trying to even out the construction of one and two so that they would be ready together. I snorted with amusement, thinking of the last couple of UN sessions. Now that the yelling was over, this was more like a project from my former life. Technical challenges and engineering issues. With the manufacturing AMIs doing all the work, I didn't even have to worry about labor issues. Negotiations still continued, of course, back on Earth. No one was willing to quietly go along with being scheduled somewhere down the road. We still had the 1500 trip issue to deal with. We didn't know for sure that it would be a death sentence, but there was general agreement that the climate on Earth was getting worse. If it got bad enough, starvation was a real possibility, despite all our efforts. Homer and his crew continued to scour the system. They'd also implemented some techniques for bringing metal up from planetside. That was slow and laborious, especially given the scale of our requirements. I'd allocated a half dozen printers to Homer. Colonel Butterworth predictably had screamed like a stuck pig, with instructions to bootstrap themselves up to a viable operation. So far, Homer was doing better than expected. The amount of refined metal on Earth was considerable, even after the war and subsequent bombardment. He'd already returned the printers to regular ship production after printing up new ones. Homer had calculated the possibilities and gone into his good news, bad news comedy routine. The good news was that we could eventually build a lot more colony ships from what he estimated we could haul up from Earth. The bad news was that everyone would be long since dead. You would think the 3D printers would have solved the scarcity problem. In fact, the technology had just moved the bottleneck. We could build more drones to extract and haul the metal out of Earth's gravity well, or we could build colony ships, or we could build more printers in order to produce more drones and colony ships, during which time we would be producing neither. The calculations to determine the optimum path were finicky and had large error bars. Even thinking about them made me grit my teeth. The drone had reached its destination. I ordered it to establish a sideways vector, then watched the video as the colony ship's exterior drifted by. Unfinished sections allowed drones and construction roamers access to the interior. A steady stream of laden drones entering the hull was matched by a stream of empty clawed drones exiting. The status window revealed no current issues. The printers were keeping up with parts demand, Homer's supply crew was keeping up with raw materials demand, and the construction crew was kept busy 24/7. I shook my head and closed the video windows. Inspection done. Homer and Charles were in Earth orbit taking a break from their outer system patrols. We took advantage of the rare opportunity to have an all-Bobs meeting. Even without commentary from Arthur, the tone was a little gloomy. The climate of the planet continued to deteriorate and was possibly accelerating.
"I think it's a given that we won't be getting 15 million people out system," Homer said. "Which means we have to come up with some way to keep them alive here."
"Triaging will help." Charles poked a finger at his copy of the holographic globe. "Emigrate the most marginal groups first, move everyone else to the most equatorial locations." I shook my head. "Most of the equatorial locations aren't habitable. Not because of climate, some of them are actually more temperate now, but because of a lack of infrastructure. Conventional bombings or falling rocks will make a city uninhabitable. Add in the problem of a lack of power and water, and you can't just drop a bunch of people off in the jungle and expect them to survive." "A lot of the jungle isn't jungle anymore," Arthur retorted.
I grimaced in response. I know, Arthur, but it doesn't change the basic point. We can't move that many people to anywhere that doesn't have infrastructure, no matter how comfortable the climate. And I don't see the point of building temporary infrastructure when it's going to delay shipbuilding. And Butterworth will have a cow. Charles smiled ruefully.
Okay, Homer interjected. Spitballing, then. How about using space mirrors to warm up the Earth?
I looked at him in surprise. Not a bad idea, in principle. A lot of unknowns, though, as it would be all new engineering. I think we'd need a minimum of 1,000 kilometers radius for a mirror to have any appreciable effect. Plus, it wouldn't do anything to clear the spreading radioactivity or repair the damaged and destroyed ecosystems, at least not within a human lifetime. And Butterworth, Charles said, smiling. We'll have a cow, we all replied in chorus. Colonel Butterworth had become a bit of a cliché with his standard reaction to any change in plan. Homer shrugged. He'd done the math, too.
Let's pass it by the colonel and see if he grabs his chest and falls over.
Space stations? Charles ventured. Same problem, though, I guess, or moon colonies. Building all the structure and infrastructure to keep people alive in space would set the colony ships back decades. And you have to build for a population density sufficient to make a dent in the 15 million or it's pointless. I nodded, glum. I'd had all these thoughts. Not really surprising that the other Bobs had too, but anything that we tried would detract from the shipbuilding. Any useful plan would need to either have negligible impact on the overall plan or would have to produce significant enough results in a short enough time to be worthwhile.
And the worst part, Arthur said, is that even if we stick to the plan as is, we probably can't save everyone.
I ran my hand through my hair. We keep coming back to this. Nothing we can think of actually improves the overall prospects. I guess all we can do is keep on keeping on and hope we stay ahead of it. I looked around at the others. No one would meet my eyes. 44. Bob, January 2166, Delta Eridani. I grinned. A black, featureless block. Dimensions 1x4x9. I leered at Marvin. He covered his face and shook his head vehemently. The strains of Also Sprach Zarathustra in the background, I continued. Marvin started to moan. As the Deltans leap about, one throws a bone into the air. Marvin dropped his hands and his eyes rolled. I waited a few more seconds for effect, then relented. So we'll just go with the drone, then. Marvin pinched the bridge of his nose. I can't believe I'm related to you. I laughed and turned to the desk. On a more realistic note, we have drones with speakers now, so we can talk to the Deltans. Honestly, I think I'll just go straight to Archimedes rather than trying to contact an elder. Oh, I agree with that. Any of the others would probably just run screeching from the area. Archimedes will be curious. I nodded. So, no background music?
Oi!
The surveillance drone showed Archimedes doing his usual patrol of the area. He varied his search from day to day and had taken to randomly digging holes, looking for more flint. A couple of the